Part 030. After Jack left, I decided I could do some light work in the plots. Nothing remarkable, just picking out a few weeds, straightening up some crooked stems, adding a string or a stick to support some plants, watering a few newly transplanted tomatoes. Mostly, I suppose, it was surveying what was there. I returned just as Mabel was dishing up some rabbit stew with dumplings. We had that quite frequently, given that it didn't require rationed meat, but I didn't mind. Mabel was careful that we got some variety day by day. Matilda was still out. Mabel said you and Jack seem to have hit it off. Yes, I like him. But I'm not sure I'm ready for a boyfriend. Last year at this time was Dunkirk and... I deliberately trailed off. Didn't put on the waterworks or anything, just let the sentence stop in midstream. Mabel filled in sorry. Yes. Takes a while. And the fellow you knew was declared missing. I'm pretty sure he's dead, unfortunately. Don't have any particular reason to believe that. Just a feeling, but a solid feeling. So I could take up with Jack if I felt like it, but I'm not sure I do. Jack probably deserves better than that. Well, he's not asked for more than a bit of an outing and a picnic, and I'd like to do that, but perhaps not too frequently while I work out what's flying around in my head. Better to be slow than get all involved than have to break it off. But if I'm any judge of things, you'll do best to tell Jack straight how you feel. Then he can make up his own mind if he's willing to hang around or go elsewhere, though you may regret the latter. Possibly. Though I'd rather I had to grind my teeth in regret than that I did Jack a disservice because I led him on then tossed a bucket of cold water on everything. Good for you, Mary. A lot of girls are selfish and don't give a toss how a man cares about them. If my Peter's any guide, men are a lot softer than they make out. Just can't seem to talk about it, of course. Silly buggers. Make life a lot easier if they just say how they feel. I answered Jack also said he's probably going to be called up when they find someone to be one of the local bobbies. So circumstances may change anyway. It seems they do that a lot in wartime. Part 031. After tea, I went up to my room. Said I was going to have a lie down and maybe an early night. Toby came too. We'd found a bit of old rag carpet that was his bed in the corner when he decided to sleep indoors. About half the time he'd lie down next to the kennel Reggie had that allowed the dogs to watch the chicken coop. I'd fixed a bit of an extension to the kennel made from a scrap of torn tarpaulin that gave a bit of shelter. Really just a roof and side tacked onto the kennel. The dogs then could both lie down and not get wet, but still look out. It occurred to me how much William hated dogs. That made me smile, and Toby must have noticed, because he gave a quiet woof and his tail wagged furiously. I didn't actually lie down. I'd realized today that I needed to get my story as tight as I could. I'd managed to get a new notepad, as well as a cheap fountain pen and some ink, along with a few pencils. That was even before I bought the exercise books to keep our log. What I wanted to do was write down my history, that is, how I would relate the life of Mary Smith. However, having it all written down might seem a bit strange if someone found my notes. This was a dilemma. I really wanted a set of notes to keep me on track. Could I put them in some sort of code? Yes. But then Discovery might have me under suspicion as an enemy agent. Well, it wouldn't be out of line for Mary Smith to have a collection of documents like her birth certificate and other things. Mabel had a drawer where she kept used envelopes and other paper, and I'd begged a few sheets of paper and a couple of envelopes. An envelope from an old Christmas card was big enough for my birth certificate and other things. I decided to add some notes. The first I wrote was Lavinia's name and address. Below I added June 1937, May 41, then tore this off the sheet so I could organize it separately. I could explain such a slip of paper as an aide memoir in case I had to get a new identity card. After all, I'd had two encounters with Mr. Hitler's bombs. I added a slip for the address of the friend with whom the real Joan Mary Smith had been blown to pieces. Then there was the address of Joan's ironmongers, but I'd not got around to putting that on the identity card. I wondered if Lavinia was still alive. Now my identity card used the address here at Gaffney's farm. I prepared slips for each, and put in the names. Again, I could say this was in case of another bomb blast. The rest center. I didn't remember the address, but it wasn't far from 39, Hollyhock Road. Mrs. Hodges had been the lady who ran the odds and sods collection, and Mrs. Appleby had tended to my injuries. I made a slip for the rest center. The more difficult bits were earlier. I had an address in Walthamstow on my birth certificate. I didn't know my grandmother's name. I was now thinking my, which I suppose was to be desired. I'd make fewer mistakes if I acted like my story was real. If I believed my own mix of the external truths and fictional inventions, I would be less likely to get caught out. I took the rest of the piece of paper, it was already written on one side, and in pencil wrote draft list of key dates and people in case of bomb. Given that I was supposed to be a double victim of bombing, I could justify wanting such a list in case of another one. From the birth certificate, I wrote down my birth date, December 10, 1917, along with the name of my mother, Beryl Smith, née Corwen, and my father, listed as Gerald, with a notation. Deceased, Cambrai about the 25th of November, 1917. Lavinia had given me two death certificates. Both used the same Walthamstow address, and named Beryl and her mother and Corwen, maiden name unknown, and Spanish flu and the dates of January the 10th and 11th, 1919. The location of the convent, or at least the residence, of the nuns who took me in wasn't on any of the few slips of paper in the collection I'd been given. But I vaguely recalled a discussion in the wages office where I'd worked, but of course Joan hadn't, where it was mentioned that death certificates had to be requested, and they were simply transcriptions from the death register for the parish or local administrative area. Someone, would it be the nuns, had taken the trouble to do that. Then I took another look at the death certificates, and saw that the informant was listed as Sister Teresa Goodwin and there was an address. Excellent. Now I had the name of one of my surrogate mothers. And I could probably be safe assuming the address was the house where they lived. Should I risk inventing a Sister Mary as another, and say that Sisters Teresa and Mary were the two who mainly looked after me? It was, if I needed it, a plausible expansion of the real details, but I would avoid using Sister Mary unless it seemed necessary to give some substance to my biography. I expanded my list. There was a thin rent book. Oh. It was for the room Lavinia rented to me. October 8, 1937 to May 4, 1940. I knew the name of the girl who died with Joan, Jane Willis, and I assumed she'd lived in the address which was destroyed in the bomb. As an invention, I'd already thought to use another girl called Doris who was with us on December 29th when we got blown up. Of course, it wouldn't take a Sherlock Holmes to go to British Home Stores and ask some awkward questions. I'd better try to come up with some sort of narrative. I realized that blast did strange things. There were tales of people found stark naked with otherwise no apparent injuries. Mary Smith could have been blown clear, but concussion was common. She could easily have been floating around a rest center or hospital for a few days. Lavinia would have had someone from the ARP or council office round to inform her that Mary Smith had perished. Then somehow, and in a confused state, I was brought or else showed up, and Lavinia took care of me. Why didn't I go back to work? Because I couldn't face seeing other people? Because I was still shaken up for a couple of months? If need be, that would be a plausible narrative. I made a slip and penciled in very abbreviated comments. There were a couple of wage stubs. They gave the address of the British Home Stores. One was from October 1937, and I decided it was likely Joan's first wages from there. There was another from May 1940, with a larger amount. A promotion. I made a note of that, it was plausible given the timing. I wondered if there were still wages owing to her estate. Well, not likely to be collected. Looking more closely at the wage stubs, I saw that they were signed V. Moore. Well, I could perhaps stretch that into something, but it wouldn't withstand a check on the actual people in the shop. A small sheet of onion skin paper was folded up with the death certificates. It was a short letter. May 3, 1940. Dear Joan, I got your letter. Good for you to get a promotion to senior sales girl. Where I am, we're keeping fit and enjoying some milder weather. Can't say where, of course. Do hope you are well and enjoying life as much as you can. Cheerio for now. Len. Couldn't call that a love letter, but it confirmed the promotion. Still, I had kept it, so Len was at least enough of a friend to be worth remembering. I had no idea of his family or what he was like. There was no address, nor a surname for Len. Concerning the laundry where I had worked, I'd only a letter of recommendation. July 31, 1937. To whom it may concern. Joan Smith worked for me in my laundry from Monday, February 13, 1933, until last week. I have, due to age and infirmity, had to retire. I can state that Miss Smith has always been a good worker, and she has my best wishes for her future. Sincerely, Eleanor Chatterton, Mrs. There was no address. It could have been written by Joan herself. I checked the entries on my draft list for the things I knew or suspected regarding the laundry, British home stores, Len, and my encounters with German bombs. A thin account. I folded it and put it in the lining of my handbag, and put a couple of tack stitches to close the opening. My envelope of documents I put in a pocket of the handbag. Those were now my real past. Part 032. By Sunday night, it was clear the Germans had attacked Russia. Well, the Soviet Union, as it was now called. We were fairly busy, despite it was Sunday, as crops were ready to harvest. I still made a short appearance at the WI meeting, but mainly to say hello and help sort out the timing for making strawberry jam. The farm would supply the strawberries, which were coming along well, but the WI would also supply women and children to help harvest. We planned, and crossed our fingers that the weather would cooperate, to harvest and jam the following Sunday. Since midsummer was yesterday, it was light until late, so we worked hard and took off a lot of vegetables before we literally fell into bed. Part 033. We had a little over a fifth of an acre dedicated to strawberries. They were in three plots, and each apparently had a different variety, though Mabel told me the main reason for separate plots was to minimize the risk of plant disease wiping out the entire crop. This year, however, we were spared that horror. Up to the time of the WI jam-making session, we'd picked about 300 pounds of strawberries. They were in demand. Indeed, Mabel said that the previous year, that was the crop of which she thought Joe Short diverted the largest proportion. This year, we'd see what the farm could produce. An average rate of production, according to the yield figures Delia had brought home, would see us pick about a ton, a long ton or 2,240 pounds, of the fruit. On the 29th, some of the WI members showed up at First Light to start picking, and I was among them, though I also picked some of our other produce that was ready, and Oliver helped me. Mabel was in charge at the byre, where we were sorting and weighing, largely with the balance scales, since strawberries don't like being crowded or then get bruised. One of the ladies of the WI worked with Mabel there, sorting the fruit. The arrangement was that the WI would get half the strawberries in exchange for picking them, with me in charge of suggesting where the picking should take place. However, jam did not need perfect fruit, so the prime berries were put into flats, weighed, and set aside in the byre. They would be collected late in the day to be offered for sale tomorrow morning in the shops. There was, of course, a bit of diversion into staff mouths. After all, we had to keep a check on the quality. On the whole, however, The WI ladies were very conscientious. The other fruit, extra ripe, bruised, or misshapen, was weighed and sent to the kitchen for washing and hulling. Matilda was in charge there, and yesterday the sugar had been delivered and stored in the front room where she slept with it. Probably a good idea, given that the black marketers would gleefully steal it. Also on Saturday, a team of WI women had come and washed a huge collection of jars, which were set out on every free surface on trays or racks that had been borrowed from wherever they could be found. These would be sterilized in one or other of the ovens of the range, and coal had been set ready to keep that hot on Sunday. Also brought in were the large cauldrons in which the jam would be cooked. Someone had also made sure we had pectin. There was a box of rubber rings to seal the jars. We were ready to make jam. Most of the early crew left mid-morning to get home to change for church. I had decided with the Gaffneys to forego church today. During the couple of hours between 9:30 and midday, I continued picking with the children, but I insisted we take breaks every half hour to conserve our energy. Around noon, a wave of women and some children who were capable of picking came to the plots, and there was a basket with a lunch of meat pies for myself and the children that somebody had been asked to bring us, along with some lemonade. With this crew of nearly 20, the pace of picking increased, and Oliver and I now spent our time showing our crew where to pick next to avoid having them pick the underripe berries or get in each other's way. Delia became a messenger to keep the pickers, the sorters, and jam makers informed of our joint progress. A couple of the stronger women had been using the wheelbarrows to move the berries from the plots to the byre and bring us fresh containers. At about 3:30, I realized we had just about exhausted the ripe fruit, and Oliver agreed, so we declared a halt to picking and rather stiffly made our way to the house. In the yard, we found a couple of the husbands who were beyond military age had brought food for a picnic tea and had set up a couple of naphtha camp stoves and had kettles steaming on each. Food was set out on some folding tables that had appeared from somewhere, and most of the chairs from the house were brought out, though a number of folded sacks were set down on the ground to sit on. At 4:00, a half-hour break was declared and two of the men volunteered to mind the pots so everyone else could enjoy a meal. The weather wasn't as fine as the previous week, but it was dry and mild enough to be comfortable outside. One of the ladies, I didn't know all their names yet, called out how many berries did we pick, Mabel? Mabel looked at a sheet of paper she had on a clipboard. Where had that come from? Then she said we weighed a total of 1,092 pounds of fruit, give or take a few ounces. I sent 550 pounds to the kitchen. A cheer went up from the assembled group in the yard. Mabel asked, to nobody in particular, how is the jam coming? Maud replied we've used a pound of sugar to each 2 of fruit, and we'll have about 800 jars of a pound of jam each. It's fortunate that we ordered 6 gross of jars and 300 weight of sugar. Whatever is left over we'll use later in the summer, but there won't be a huge surplus, which would be embarrassing and likely get us in trouble with the ministry people. One of the other pickers asked how many jars are filled already. Maud answered about half, and the pots have half the rest of the fruit almost done, and the remainder is already heating. We'll be done by around 6 and cleared away by 7. That's pretty well what happened. Matilda shrewdly insisted that we clean all the spoons and plates on which we'd rested them by putting them in one of our large saucepans with the smallest amount of water possible. That way we got a rather thin strawberry syrup that we left on the back of the range overnight to evaporate down. It was still very thin, but usable to provide some sweetness in desserts for a few days. We weren't going to waste a thing. On the Tuesday night, a small group of women would come back to stick on labels that we had managed to get printed. A leap of faith had led to a large number of labels being printed with just our WI name and a box where the nature of the product and date would be entered. One of the ladies had a son who had a John Bull printing outfit. The young lad did a good job of making up. Strawberry jam. June 1941. But another lady had borrowed an inking pad from her husband's office, since it worked much better than the one supplied with the printing outfit. Apparently, the inking pads in the kits were never very good. We were hoping and intending to make other jams and similar products later, so avoiding specifics as to content and date on the labels seemed a good idea. Let's hope we are right. Part 034. June 30th, Monday, 1941. We decided to sleep in the next morning, that is, a half hour more in bed. Farms don't let you stay longer. We had a cup of tea and some bread and jam, there was a little that wouldn't fill a jar and was in a small bowl, and rushed to get the latest crops harvested. The van from Ilminster came for the strawberries and the other things I'd managed, with the help of Oliver, to harvest yesterday and, in a bit of a hurry, this morning. The children were off to school by then. A couple more weeks until summer holidays. Then Mr. Jessop came and took the Taunton deliveries. Finally, around 10 o'clock, we took a break and Matilda presented us with mushrooms on toast. They certainly tasted wonderful. Sadly, just as we finished, the telephone rang. Mabel answered it, and I heard her say, "Oh no. How awful." She said nothing for a bit, then very deliberately said, "All right, I'll tell her, and we'll come to your place and figure out what to do." When she came back to the kitchen, she was crying. She went over to Matilda, who was sitting at the table, and put her arms round her. "It's Dad. Someone came round to help repair the bomb damage and found him sitting in his armchair." Matilda asked, very flatly, "Is he dead?" "Yes. The doctor who came said it looked like a heart attack." Matilda said, "Dr. Waterfield had said he should watch out. He had a bit of a spell a year ago. We didn't tell you, as we didn't want you to worry." Both women were crying quietly. Mabel said Maud asked us to come to her, and we'll decide what to do. I said I can probably manage here. I think I know most of what needs to be done. Mabel just nodded her assent, and then she and Matilda got ready to leave. Reggie watched them cautiously. He sensed something had happened. Funny dog. Toby, on the other hand, stuck close to me. Part 035. As I was on my own, I locked the house before I went back to the plots. Jack had mentioned crime was up. I'd initially taken to putting a couple of envelopes under the mattress of my cot with my documents, my Mary Smith ones, and most of my money. I kept some money in a small purse I'd had for years in my trouser pocket on the left side, and my identity card was there too in its paper folder. The money purse was the type that folded together and it had a small section where you could put folded paper like a 10-bob note and it would not get rubbed against coins. My Swiss Army knife lived in the right side trouser pocket with a handkerchief. The knife had a loop at one end of the handle, and I found a keyring that I looped onto this and on which I put the house key Mabel had given me. A couple of weeks ago I'd bought a padlock and some chain from George to use with the bike I was riding. Another key on the ring. That same day I'd gone looking for some sort of means to lock up my private things. In a second-hand furniture shop I found a very scratched footlocker. It was about 24 by 15 by 12 inches and had a hinged top and a lock, but no key. And it was locked. "Is there a key anywhere that fits this?" I asked the old man at the till. "No, never found one." "That rather diminishes its value," I commented. "5 bob and it's yours." "Done," I said. I had to balance the footlocker on the crossbar and handlebars of the bike and walk beside it rather than ride. Rather than go home, I was now thinking of the farm as home, I went back to the ironmongery. George took one look and went to his storeroom where he had a box with assorted keys in it. "I keep these just in case. Maud's been on at me to toss them out, or at least send them to be melted down again. Why don't you sit out back in the yard and try a few?" It was slow going. I sat on a step and spread out the keys on the concrete surface of the step beside me. Some were clearly too big, and others too small, so I put those back in the box. Then there were some dozens of might-be keys. After almost half an hour, one of them fitted well and there was a substantial click when I turned it. The lid now came open. Inside the box were a few letters in envelopes and a photo album. And dust. Well, I could clean that out. Time was getting on, and clouds were threatening a shower, so I put all the keys back except the one that worked and took the box back to George with thanks. How much do I owe you for the key, George? A smile will do, George laughed, and I thanked him profusely and loaded the box again and made haste to get home before the rain. I didn't avoid getting wet, of course, as I had work to do on the crops. However, I was able to put on my sailing jacket and only got mildly damp. It did mean that I spent some time that evening putting more dubbin on my boots. It was critical for me to keep my footwear in good condition. Before I went to sleep that night when I'd acquired the footlocker, I opened, emptied and cleaned it. I looked in the photo album, but the entries gave no hint of the identity of the people in the images. Aunt Joan at Bournemouth. Mom and Dad on their 25th anniversary. Some of the scratches and gouges in the box suggested it may have come out of a bomb site. The half-dozen letters were more helpful. All but one were addressed to the same location in Bristol. I thought of writing to the address to say what I'd found, then decided to wait. I decided to read the letters. The contents of the envelope addressed to a street in Cardiff surprised me. 2 £5 notes, plus a very short message. To Daisy, happy 21st, Uncle George. I ordered the other envelopes by the postmark. They were all written in the same hand, which differed from that of Uncle George. The first letter was mostly mundane personal news from the writer, someone named Jenny. However, it did contain one line that intrigued me. I'm glad you've got away from George. The rest of the letters concerned rather common everyday life of two women. Neither gave any specifics of where they worked or lived, apart from the address where Daisy was apparently living or collecting her post. The tone of the correspondence was guarded. Daisy Brompton, for that was the name to which they were addressed, was possibly escaping, much as I had, though George wasn't her husband. A pervert of an uncle? People didn't talk much about such things, and in some ways I found it hard to imagine a family member could try to. But then until William hit me, I couldn't imagine that happening either. Life could be nasty sometimes. I put the letters in the album and put it back in the footlocker after wiping out that box. Then I added some of my own things, including my handbag. I decided that I'd avoid using it and look for a new one, since it was a link to my former self, though I didn't yet feel I wanted to dispose of it. My keyring now had 3 keys. There was a house key in my handbag still. I wondered if I'd ever use it again. Part 036. Mabel found me working on weeding, tidying and picking vegetables. It was about 2:30. I'd not bothered with lunch after the toast and mushrooms, but I had brought an old lemonade bottle of water with me. I said, I'm sorry about your father. Thanks. It's not unexpected, actually. He told me himself last year, but he asked me not to let Mum know that I knew. What's going to happen now? I asked. Maud and Mum are going to Yeovil to sort things out about a funeral. I'll go down with the children on the train the night before the funeral, but try to get back right after. Maud's going to stay with Mum for a few days to sort out the house. They don't own it, so Mum's coming back here to live, but we need to figure out which furniture and other stuff to keep. We've some space in our attic, and Maud and George do too. However, if Maud and I can, we want to persuade Mum to sell anything that's likely just to sit around using space. It'll take some delicacy, I said. She probably has attachments and memories. Yes, we don't want to cause her more upset if we can avoid it. Anyway, George thinks he knows someone who might be able to help bring over whatever she wants to keep as long as it's not too bulky. Right now it's difficult to get a lorry with the fuel restrictions, but we know a fellow with an old horse and cart, actually a rag and bone man, who'll do it, though it'll take him a few days. It's over 25 miles each way and the old horse won't be rushed. I'll look after the labelling of the jam tomorrow night, and I'm sure Jackie Hazelton knows what's going to be done with it all. Yes. She'll look after getting it where it has to go and the proper records. Since it's rationed at 8 ounces per month, each of our jars has to be sold to a couple, or given out as a 2-month allocation. We did think of 8-ounce jars, but that makes so much more work, so we've got ones that are supposed to be a pound. That's why we figured out the level to fill them yesterday using the scales. We made sure nobody got short measure, assuming the jars were a uniform size, of course. The rationing makes a lot more work, but we've definitely wasted no fruit. That's for sure. Part 037. Matilda returned over the August bank holiday weekend. She just wanted to keep one particular, and not very bulky, armchair, a trunk full of her clothing and linen, and some mementos, along with some crockery and cutlery. However, despite grieving, she had had the sense to get both Mabel and Maud to bring empty suitcases to the funeral. These were put to good use to bring as much as possible back to Taunton as each daughter returned. I hadn't seen Matilda since the day of the fateful telephone call from Maud. She was subdued all that first weekend. Reggie, as always sensitive to people, lay down beside her chair, which we decided should be installed in the kitchen, each the evening before going to his kennel for the night. Wednesday morning, however, Matilda came out to where I was harvesting spinach and lettuce and suggested it could be more efficient if she picked and I moved the filled flats back to the byre. We'd arranged a pickup for that evening, so I was working as fast as I could to get everything ready. Mabel was in a different area, checking on some other plants and also picking the last of the strawberries. They weren't the best quality, and we had an idea to make a fruit compote with them and some other odds and ends of fruit. Part 038. Somehow through the summer I started to find the work, tough and long though it was, getting easier for me. Bit by bit, I was getting physically stronger. With the crops coming in steadily, there wasn't much time off, but Jack would sometimes drop by of an evening and would go for a walk or a bike ride. He found a pair of lights for me, as if the sun set on us I'd be illegal to ride, and with a policeman. I insisted on paying him back for this, which launched us into a discussion of how we should continue. Mary, can't you just take the lamps as a present? I suppose I could, but I don't feel right about it. As far as I can tell, we're not seeing other people, are we? Both of us seem to be working every minute that there is on the clock. That's true. But, give me a moment to get my thoughts and I'll try to explain. All right, but I'm getting suspicious I won't like what I'm about to hear. I kept silent for a few seconds, then said Jack. My feelings are that I'd very much like to be your girl. So my, reticence isn't about that. I really and truly hope that we stay friends for many, many years. And possibly more than friends. On the other side, the war means we lose people. Len you know about. My father at Cambrai in the last one, and probably my mother and grandmother too, at least in the form of the flu that it seems to have spawned. And you've mentioned that you're not sure what the future holds for you. You're young and fit, and only an accident of your occupation is stopping the army or whatever from taking you away. And that would be away from me, and the closer I am to you now, the harder it'll be when you go, no matter whether you come back. And even if you come back from the services, the time apart might leave our friendship damaged. I hope you'll still come by and ask me to walk or ride with you. Maybe even go to the pictures or a dance. But I'd really like us to keep it somewhat like two chums, where we each pay our own way. I know that isn't really going to work, but for now I'd like to pretend it's like that while things are still so uncertain. I stopped talking and for a while there was silence. Then Jack said I liked the bit about being possibly more than friends. And you've reason enough to feel the way you do, So I'll keep Mum on the boyfriend-girlfriend bit and see what comes. Thanks, Jack. I don't know what made me do it, but I gave him a kiss and got one back. Fortunately, Jack had the good sense not to prolong it. He said better get back before the sun is down, and we walked hand in hand back to the farm. Part 039. Around the end of August, Jack was sent away for firearms training. He said he wasn't specifically told it was a secret where the training would take place, but thought it best to not say, and I told him I agreed. Loose lips and all that. He said the brass want as many of us as possible able to use firearms in case we need to respond to a threat. Initially that was invasion, but now more likely downed Luftwaffe people or escaped POWs, or perhaps some commando raid. Are they training everyone in the police? I asked. Possibly, though I don't think so. And though I've no real evidence, I have a suspicion that there may be some development such as a special unit to jump in when there are reports of parachutes or prisoner escapes. That is, I've got this feeling the training is not just in case, but more because I may get called for special duty. Would that mean you'd not have to walk the beat? Jack laughed. Not bloody likely. Probably mean I get to walk the beat all day, then run after some Nazi bastard all night getting shot at. Still, I'd probably get a promotion and a chance to learn lots. Be careful what you wish for, I cautioned. Yes, Jack said quietly. If I'm given any choices, I'd better think them through carefully. Isn't it always a good idea to think about choices? Yes. Certainly. But how many of us do? True. Sadly true, I said. We were quiet for a few minutes, sitting outside a nearby pub. Jack, despite being born and bred in Somerset, preferred bitter. I liked most of the local cider, but always kept to a half pint. It could knock you off your feet for some reason that went beyond the alcohol. There were lots of stories of people sitting at the side of the road. I'm not drunk. Just my legs not working right. And apparently, they weren't drunk. They could think and talk just fine. But like they said, their legs wouldn't carry them. Jack said you seem to have settled in well with the Gaffneys. I have. The hours are long and the work is heavy and sometimes dirty and wet, but I'm happy there. Probably as happy as I've ever been. Not often good comes of one of those parachute mines. Some people call them landmines, but strictly those are the ones that blow you up when you step on them or a vehicle drives over them. Dudley had a parachute mine kill 10 people last November, then on the 12th just past another killed a further 5. Didn't you say you were blasted by one of the damn things? What was I prepared to reveal? I saw a parachute coming down. And there was an explosion. So I said, well, I can say I saw a parachute in the moonlight and when it got about where I guess was roof level there was an almighty bang, though I'd ducked down by then. I suppose the parachute could have been someone bailing out of a plane, and the explosion was another type of bomb, but I don't think so. You know, I possibly wouldn't be here except I desperately needed to pee and we had a bucket at the back of the, here I nearly said roof, but realized that wasn't Mary Smith's story. I continued after a short pause, I suppose you'd say garden shed. I was down the road from my new employers and someone said come in their Anderson shelter. When I said I needed to go, the lady who invited me in the shelter with her and her two kiddies said there was a bucket next to the shed that was mostly out of view. When I saw the parachute I had to whip up my knickers and then I lay down. The dirt on the Anderson probably took a lot of the blast, but some came round the ends. A lot of stuff fell on the shelter and caved in part of it where I'd been sitting. And Mabel had to cut my hair because I had tar in it, I think probably melted roof tar or something like that blown about by the blast. So that's where your hair went. Actually, I should have had it cut before. Used to have to put in rollers every night. What a nuisance. Yes, I don't think I'd like to have to do that. Can you even sleep with rollers in? A great many women do, but I've got to say they used to wake me up when I rolled over in my sleep. I had to be careful. William had insisted I have long hair. Don't want any wife of mine looking like a boy. Jack didn't seem to care. He said the shorter hair suits you. Thank you. I like it this way too. That evening I realized that I had never said that I was on a roof. Damn. I'd have to be careful. What I told Jack was a more suitable story, as long as nobody checked with the fictional lady with an Anderson shelter. Still, I could say that I never got her name. Lots of people had near misses in shelters. That's what I'd told the ARP man when I had arrived where I'd seen the mine blast. Better say no more, but remember now what I'd told Jack.